Linoleum knife.
Podcast du cinéma.
Yes. good afternoon, Alonzo Duraldi. Of the rap. And of other... What the flick?
Thank you, Dave White of linoleum-knife.com.
Well.
Are you even of that? I guess listen, you're Dave White of the rap for all intents and purposes.
Currently, I am sort of Dave White from the rap.
Yeah.
Recently, I mean, it wasn't my intention to
mine.
Part of the rap, but, you know, what was it, like once or twice last year, I think, I stepped in at the last minute to...
Emergency fill-in.
And then through a series of, you know, personnel changes in your critics lineup, some things were still about to get fallen through the cracks. And this has happened
a few times
recently. And so
I'm working on closing that gap, but, you know.
You know, it's hard to find... It's hard to find people who can do that thing. And so...
Especially when it involves a quick turnaround.
I've been very hesitant to say yes to these assignments because, you know, it was kind of like back when you were one of the editors at The Advocate back in whatever year it was,
2000 to 2006.
Yeah. And I remember you came home and you said, we need someone to write about hip-hop. Someone gay to write about hip-hop. We can't find anybody. And I said, well, I could, but you're my husband and that's not... That feels like a weird conflict, you know? And so... You sent me to your boss.
Right, and she was your editor.
And she was my editor. This time, there's not even that much of a remove because you're my editor. I mean, your boss has been fine with me being there,
right,
doing those things.
You're a qualified, experienced film critic.
I agree with you.
And it's not like we don't edit each other's stuff all the time anyway. I read you pretty much everything I write before I post it, and you read me your stuff. So this is just me reading it and making changes myself before I post it.
You know? I just don't like the idea that there might be anyone out there saying, well, look who got a reviewing gig at the rep because his husband's the reviews editor.
Yeah,
you know?
That's not how
like, that is... That's the thing I don't... That's the thing that always makes me think, I have to be really good.
You are...
I have to turn this in. My copy has to be clean enough. My sentences have to be not 1,000% garbage. Like, if they're 200% garbage, that's acceptable, I suppose.
You are eminently qualified. And, you know, and frankly, I feel lucky to have you on things like God's Not Dead 2, because I think you bring a level of analysis to the table that most... film critics don't.
I am the I'm the boss reviewing the Christian movies. But, so that's, I mean...
Even when they don't have lesbians and...
Lately, I'm with the rap. So, you know, when your bosses say, hey, which they don't do, I mean, like...
And once I am able to rebuild my bench, you know, to a larger extent, I mean, I'm making...
Who knows? Maybe when you rebuild your bench to a larger extent, I'll still want to stay on.
We'll see.
Maybe I'll just take over.
You do that.
How you like that idea?
You do that.
I know I have to go see Captain America: Civil War for you on Tuesday night.
I wish I could go. It's my teaching night.
Yeah.
And Yeah, don't even start me on this. I'm really annoyed with how the publicity for this film is being handled, but that's a topic for off mic.
I'm happy to fill in the gaps as they are as they happen.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Before we get into films, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of them this week, so we need to make this, we need to be mindful of our time.
Sure.
This week. Speaking of things that happen off the mic, a famous filmmaker called you this week. Now, for the purposes of this conversation,
we will call him Director X.
and we're going to use the pronoun him, because most successful, very well-known directors in the United States are men. And so this person might be a man. This person might be a woman. We cannot name names. We cannot name the film in question. We cannot really say any of the details.
I will be vague about the details.
But you got a phone call.
So I'm lying on the couch, and the phone rings. And, you know, on your phone now, it'll sort of tell you where it's coming from, even if it's not a name that's in your
And the call was coming
directory.
From inside the house.
The call was coming from inside the house. No, it was coming from Beverly Hills, you know. And I thought, okay, it's probably some publicist.
That's where they all live there,
in Beverly Hills. I pick up the phone, and this voice says, "I have Director X on the line." And I pause. I'm like, "I'm sorry, what?" "I have Director X on the line."
Director X is a very, very well-known director.
Yeah, and one whose voice you would know.
Decades of work.
Yes, you would know. If you
heard this person speak, you would know it was this person on
exactly.
the phone.
So
would know it wasn't a prank.
I figured if this is a prank, I'll know immediately. So I'm like, all right, put him through. "Hi, Alonzo, it's Director X." I was like, okay. You would understand why I would think this entire call was a prank, right? And he laughs like, oh, yeah, no, I understand. But no, it's me. So then I put him on speaker because Dave's in the room looking at me like, who are you talking to? What is going on? So Director X had a film out last year that underperformed at the box office and underperformed, he thought, with critics.
Critically, yeah.
Yeah, and he was not mad. He was not, like, coming after me because I was not super fond of the film, which I was not, admittedly. But apparently reads me and wanted to kind of get my feedback about how Rotten Tomatoes works because he said that, you know, he felt that this was a film that was trying to do something different that wasn't like, you know, your usual superhero movie and that it had tested, well, like up there with, you know, his best films. And he said he knew that critics might not like some things about it, but that they would like other things. And he said that a lot of the reviews felt very mixed and that they did indeed. There were parts they were down for and others they weren't for.
Yeah.
But then he couldn't figure out why so many of those mixed reviews then translated to Rotten Tomatoes or to what he called, please.
Best quote of the entire conversation. Why did it come up as a splat instead of a juicy red tomato? It was all I could do not to burst out laughing. Because obviously, you know, you've got him on speaker and I'm...
Yeah, juicy red tomato I was not expecting. And so I explained how, you know, unfortunately Rotten Tomatoes operates as a binary. It's, you know, fresh, rotten, up, down, yes, no, 1-0. You know, there aren't a lot of areas in between, and that it's sort of up to each critic to kind of decide, well, you know, this is a mixed review, but is it mixed more in a positive way or in a negative way? And I said that I generally, if I was very mixed on a film, if I leaned negative, I would then at least try and give a quote that indicated that there were things about the movie I liked, and vice versa, if it were mixed and I gave it a fresh, I made sure my quote expressed a certain degree of ambivalence or
right.
pointed out things that didn't work. Anyway,
we know the folks at Rotten Tomatoes, yeah. obviously.
I mean, it's
a useful tool,
absolutely. And I see, you know, people certainly go to it, and it's an easy shorthand. But as with anything else, and as I told Director X, I never like to have a grade or a score or stars or any of that stuff because people will read that and then not read the review.
They don't read anything, and then when they do read, Y'all, reading comprehension is a real problem in the world, even among educated people.
As somebody from the Washington Post tweeted this week, if I wrote the way people read, I'd be fired.
Seriously, if you read something that kind of bothers you in the media, go back and read it again slowly, out loud to yourself, so that you really do get what it is you're reading.
Or if somebody is, if you clicked on some article that's about another article, go read the original article, because it could be that the thing you clicked on was somebody totally misinterpreting it or stretching things out of proportion to sort of get clicks or whatever. But yeah, people don't read entire reviews enough anymore. And so, you know, as
people don't get figurative language.
Yeah. As handy as Rotten Tomatoes can be, I feel like it does encourage a certain level of, like, you know, you get an outlying idea of what critics thought, but you don't really get the same level that you would if you actually stop and read all those reviews. Not in every single one, but the reviews of the critics that you like or that you trust or that you think have an interesting point of view,
right,
whether or not it's your point of view. So we talked about all that stuff, and he was very nice and very cordial, was clearly just wanting to know.
He wasn't even mad at you for your half good, half bad review.
I think it was a very fair review. It was weird, though, now, because when he said, oh, I read you, then, of course, after the conversation, I went back and dug up all of my reviews of Director X movies. And thought, oh, my God, what did I say? But no, it was fine.
You should, you know what? Not your problem.
No. And I'm not going to dial it back for him in the future. But it's cool. And I mean, I know that I write for a site that people in the industry read, but I rarely ever think about the fact that I write stuff that is read by people, as do a lot of our peers. The stuff, the things we put out in the world get read and get listened to.
I'm always aware of my audience.
When we're on Madeline Brand,
that's like, why I'm so charming and cute.
People in Los Angeles are listening to that. You know,
true.
It's nutty. So it was a very, very kind, pleasant conversation. I told him afterwards, you know, I really admired a lot of his work, and you know, I referenced an anecdote to you know, having seen him in public at one point and being a mensch, and not being like gross and famous. Yeah, it was very nice. And then after I hung up, I thought, how did he get my number? You don't have to be the spy to figure that out. I'm sure.
You're the only Alonzo Duralde
on the planet. That's a starter, I suppose.
Yeah, and so...
But I think also, I'm sure one or other of the studios that he works for, all he has to do is, I'm sure, I have Director X on the line for you, just called their publicity department.
Yes, sir, what can I do for you, sir?
How do I track down this clown?
How do I hunt this film critic and kill him?
So that was the thing that happened this week.
It was very strange.
It was quite bizarre.
My mouth was agape the entire conversation. I sat across the room thinking, how is this happening? What's going on? Why are you talking to this person? Why does this person care about you? Furthermore, why does this person not understand Rotten Tomatoes very well?
Well, this person is older. You know.
So, listen, Director X, if you're listening to this podcast right now...
I doubt that greatly.
I'd say I like about 50% of your movies. The others, I think, are kind of dumb, but we're still cool. Yeah.
And now the weird thing is, like, if in some bizarre situation I'm next to him, like, you know, at an airport or something.
You're going to be like, hey, what's up, man? Hey, Director X. Remember our special phone conversation?
Yeah.
Remember that time we bonded and I explained internet stuff to you?
The juicy tomato.
That was very strange.
It was very
strange. Now, here's my, I don't know. Have you asked other film critics if they have had similar experiences with other filmmakers?
I asked one the other day after a screening, as we were both walking back to our cars. I said,
like, who reaches out and to whom do they reach?
And this was a big player that we know in this world. I said, have you ever been called by a director? He goes, no. And I said, oh, well, I have a story for you. He thought it was quite funny.
I wonder how often that has ever happened.
Surely it must. I mean, it's not like we're the hardest people to track down. You know, we used to have offices and desks at newspapers, you know.
True, yeah. It only ever happened to me once. way back in the day,
like iFilm.
Like at iFilm
Wow.
back in 2000, I wrote a review of an indie film directed by the son of a very famous producer. And this film is garbage. Like, just the inept, terrible, petulant, awful nonsense. That's what I said in the review. And he emailed me. And he said I was garbage. And I was like, so's your movie.
Really? Did you respond or
Basically, yeah.
Oh, the early days of the internet bringing us all together.
I mean, I don't know that that guy has made another movie since,
Well,
if at all, if maybe he has. If he has, I haven't heard of him.
I'm sure he's crying into a mound of cocaine in the Caymans as
I
we
don't
speak.
know. I cannot speak to this person's drug use, but I know that he's inherited some money, so you
Yeah.
know, happy life to you, sir, who made the terrible, terrible film.
We're making a difference in people's lives. Anyway.
I would like to get two movies out of the way
Okay.
quickly because they are films that I don't think we should talk about much about what happens in them.
Oh, okay, good point. Yes. So the first one being
And then I would like to do, well, these films are Midnight Special
Right.
and The Invitation.
Correct.
The Midnight Special opened a few weeks ago, and you saw it before its release, and you reviewed it.
No, it opened a few weeks ago just in New York and Los
Right,
Angeles.
and
And
then limit,
then.
and then it expanded a bit last week,
Right. And
and
a
it
bit more this week, I
maybe
think.
expanded a little more this week, but I know it's playing in a wider capacity
Yeah.
right now. I finally just got to see it this morning.
Yes. And it's hard for me to talk about what didn't work for me and not talk
Without
about
talking about the
spoilers.
ending.
Because that's, yeah, the basically the final chunk of the film is where it totally loses me.
And then, but it's about, it stars, it's from,
Jeff Shannon. Not Jeff
no,
Shannon, Jeff Nichols.
Jeff Nichols
Directing Michael Shannon
directing Michael
again.
Shannon again. He previously worked with Shannon in Take Shelter.
And Mud and Shotgun
He
Stories.
was also in Mud,
Yes.
was he?
He has a supporting role in Mud.
Okay, that's right, that's right.
And Shotgun
I've
Stories.
never seen Shotgun
I have not
Stories,
either, but I've
and
heard good
now I
things.
want to see it. This is a movie about a father and a son on the run. The son has special abilities that is shown in the trailer, and it is told very quickly and early in the film.
Se several groups of people want the kid.
They are on the run from more than one group of folks, and these folks all want the kid for different reasons.
Right.
The kid is, like I say, special. And then stuff happens. And then really wild stuff happens. And you and I differ on this one.
Yes.
You feel like it fell apart at the end. I do not. I feel like it's absolutely coherent and sticks to itself and sticks to its own plan from beginning to end. It offers you up a fantastical kind of situation at the beginning and only continues with that as the film goes on. What are you about to say?
No,
I see you taking a breath like you're going to speak.
I'm trying to figure out what I can say that's not a spoiler. I will just say that it ended up reminding me very strongly of two movies that I don't care
Oh, I see.
for.
And I think I can say this without giving anything away. I don't know a lot about Jeff Nichols as a person. I don't know biographical details, but I do know that my opinion is that he works pretty squarely within the realm of an auteur sort of paradigm.
That's my impression
He
so far,
writes the
yeah.
films, he directs the films, he seems to exert a high degree
He's from Arkansas.
of control that makes perfect sense, a high
Yes.
degree of control over what he does.
Uh-huh.
I feel like moves that are made in the film are his moves. They are authorial. They are not bound by someone else coming in and saying, you know, I'm the investor of this film, or I'm the big producer, and I'm going to tell you what to do.
Oh, no, no. I don't think that there's any of that at play. I think
he calls the shots.
Sure, yeah. And this is his first studio movie, by the way.
And I wonder... that's another thing. Blows my mind, honestly, that Warner Brothers...
Yes, well, this is apparently exactly the kind of movie they're not going to be making anymore.
Why?
Well, they have. Didn't you see that article I posted that after Batman v Superman disappointed, that they're slashing back on the number of movies they're putting out every year, and basically everything on their docket now is like Justice League, Harry Potter, you know,
Harry Potter,
yeah, like you know, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find like the prequels and stuff.
What?
Or where oh my God, where are you? How do you not know any of this?
Let me tell you how. I will tell you how. I don't have to know about stuff that's dumb. That's the first thing. Not that Harry Potter's dumb, but giant corporate industrial cinema is not my bag, baby. Well, and therefore, even though I am on this show and I write about it and I'm writing about Captain America and I love the Captain America movies, my attention is drawn away ever so easily by the fact that the new Alexander Sokurov movie opens this Friday at the Royal. It's called Francophonia.
How nice.
And it reminds
you.
Me a lot, the trailer at least, of Russian Ark. And I'm so very excited.
How nice.
That, forgive me,
for
I didn't
you.
Know that the new Harry Potter prequelisms were coming.
Well, obviously, you also aren't on all the mailing lists that I'm on from the studios, because every time there's
I am. I just don't open those emails.
Well, I don't either, but I see the header.
Oh, I ignore those. I just bleep right over them, like Russian names and Brothers Dostoevsky, Brothers Karamazov.
Well, bully for you, Linus Van Pelt. Anyway, but everything on the Warner Brothers slate now is Harry Potter, Lego, Justice League, like all their franchisey stuff.
Okay, well,
so Midnight Special may be the last of these kinds of off-book movies.
Let me reiterate, the big corporate industrial films are entertaining, and sometimes they're really good.
Mm-hmm.
But the pre-release information, I'm not... no one's paying me to pay attention to that. And
I don't, but you know, it's funny. You say this stuff as though I were slavishly hanging on every word of it. I'm not. I just
slavishly or slavishly?
I don't know.
I think it's slavishly.
That came out of my mouth and I was half thinking about lavishly. I don't know. In any event, I'm not following this stuff either. I don't go to those websites, but just between looking at my Facebook wall and getting emails and living in the world, I see that this stuff is happening.
I didn't know there was Harry Potter stuff coming.
You're the one person who was surprised at the end of Prometheus that it was an alien movie.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about that.
I don't know
in.
How you...
I walked into that one cold.
I don't know how you've constructed this bubble for yourself.
It's real easy and also fun.
It's not that easy.
It's actually quite easy. The minute you hear the words DC Universe or Marvel Universe or Harry Potter, you just go, I'll learn about that when it's in front of my eyes. Until then, I got no dog in that hunt, and I got no dog in helping people be excited about that stuff. Let them be excited.
Okay,
go ahead and be excited if you want to be excited.
Again.
But I'm not interested in being excited about stuff before I see it.
Okay, again. Your implication here is that because I'm aware of this stuff, I care, or that I want people to be excited, or any of that stuff.
You are the reviews editor of therap.com, and therefore, someone is paying you to know the stuff in advance. And actually, you're the one that has to go, like, come up with ideas for, you know, think pieces about certain things from time to time. Ben Affleck as Batman, for example, that article that you had to write. But that's not... I just write a review. I get paid to write a review. Linoleum Knife subscribers pay me to watch television and send them things in the mail. By the way, if you're a Linoleum Knife subscriber on Patreon, if you have joined our club and you haven't emailed me with your t-shirt sizes and preferences of items, and you're at the subscription level at which these things are to be sent to you, get on it. Like I said last week, if you don't, you get socks.
It's amazing how you think somehow you are too artsy cool to know about what's happening in Harry Potter. And yet, you have to explain to me who Black China is.
Look, I need to explain some things to you.
Like, you are completely versed in Kardashian world. But somehow knowing about how the Harry Potter movie is like, oh, offends your delicate aesthetic sensibilities. Ew.
Listen, I liked all those Harry Potter movies. And you know what? I'm down for going to that Harry Potter land or whatever it is they just opened over across the freeway.
Yes.
But whatever the new movie is coming out, whatever new movie they have coming out, what it's about or who is in it or when it's happening, I'm going to wait for the email that tells me that it's about to screen.
Okay, but see, here's the thing.
And then I'll go.
I don't open these emails. I don't chase this stuff at all.
I get it.
I know that Eddie Redmayne is in it.
Thank you for telling me about that.
And I know
does
that
does he play a wizard or a goblin?
I don't know.
Does he have a face?
I don't know.
Is he like Dobby or whatever?
I know what you're saying. Yeah. I don't know anything else. I just know that he's in it, and I know it's a thing that is happening. So anyway, yes, so Warner Brothers is not going to be releasing any more Midnight Specials anytime soon.
What if this does really well? Will he, like, get his way back into them somehow? Will they be like, oh, your last movie made money on this amount of dollars?
Yeah, here, Jeff Nichols, why don't you do the Lego Breaking Bad movie? Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, that was a huge digression.
Oh, on this program?
In which I was correct. The thing that I was about to say was, because I don't know much biographical information about Jeff Nichols, but now having seen three of his films, I had a lot of questions about where he comes from.
Little Rock.
He came up, what his ideas about religion are.
He gets the South, I think, pretty well.
Oh, boy, does he.
I think, like, he and David Gordon Green are sort of the auteurs of the South right
now.
And
he takes his rural people and puts them in extraordinary situations. And I'm seeing some things, some patterns in these stories. Elements that keep coming back. Very Terrence Malick-ish. In a way, honestly. Frankly, this movie had some shots that reminded me of Malick.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, do I like this movie. We're going to start talking about The Invitation now. We're going to talk about it even less than about Midnight Special.
Exactly. Except that we both liked The Invitation.
And then I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. But The Invitation is the new movie from Karen Kusama.
Yes.
Who made Girl Fight.
Right.
The film that gave Michelle Rodriguez her career.
Yes. And Jennifer's Body, which is apparently the movie that put Karen Kusama in movie jail for a long time. I think she also did Aeon Flux.
Oh, did she?
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, here's the thing.
Which Aeon Flux is exactly the kind of movie that a studio offers you when you made Girl Fight.
Right. This is the best movie that Karen Kusama has made. And if it's an indication of where she wants to go and what she wants to do and what she's capable of, then thank goodness we have Karen Kusama in the world. Now, I don't know who wrote this, but she didn't.
She did not
write it. Yeah. And the screenplay is a good, 50% of this really awesome equation. I will tell you enough of the plot.
Hang on. I'm going to credit the screenwriters. Okay. It's always important that we do that. Phil Hay and Matt Manfredi.
Where are they from?
Phil Hay. Oh, my God. He's written some awful movies.
Like?
Ride Along 2.
Okay, sure, whatever.
Ride Along.
All right.
He has a story credit on RIPD.
Oh, my.
He wrote the Clash of the Titans remix.
Wow.
He wrote Aeon Flux.
Okay.
He has a story credit on The Tuxedo. Jackie Chan.
Oh, man.
And he wrote Crazy Beautiful.
Seriously. Who's the other cat?
The other guy. Boy, just goes to show you can't judge people on what they... Oh, I guess they're screenwriting partners because they've got pretty much
the same things.
All the same stuff, yeah.
Well, here's what.
So these guys wrote the Ride Along movies?
This goes to show that you take gigs for money sometimes.
Yeah.
And you do what they tell you.
And sometimes you've got the good one in a drawer.
And you get that money and then you got the good one in the drawer and you go get that good one made.
Yeah. They also co-directed a movie called Bug, not the one Not the
Michael Shannon.
Not the Michael Shannon one.
Okay.
One with John Carroll Lynch, who was in The Invitation, and Brian Cox and Grant Heslov and Jamie Kennedy and Sarah Paulson. I've never heard of this. Ed Begley Jr.
Okay, so The Invitation is about a dinner party that happens in the Hollywood Hills. If you live in the Hollywood Hills, there's a 99.99% chance that you are sitting on some cash.
Or inherited it.
Or inherited some cash. Somebody got you some cash and you got a house in the hills. That's what you should know about the Hollywood Hills. We have some friends that live in the Hollywood Hills. They got money. And so
parking at their house is always a pain in the butt.
No, actually, the two houses that I'm thinking of have pretty easy parking because the streets are wider and they're not windy.
True, I suppose, relatively speaking.
You get up on those windy hills that are built for like a car and a half.
Yeah, and you've had it.
Then you're doomed, yeah. Anyway, this party takes place in the hills. That is a relevant detail. And this party does not go the way you would expect or hope a dinner party would go. And that is everything that I'm going to tell you. It stars Logan Marshall Green, who is the Tom Hardy lookalike from Prometheus, and a few other things.
Yeah.
He hasn't worked a lot, and I'm wondering if, I mean, he's worked some. He's been on like a couple shows, and he's had some, you know, medium-sized roles in some films. He has a career. It continues. It's not like he goes long periods of time without working. But it makes me wonder if his striking resemblance to Tom Hardy has helped or hurt him.
Well, yeah, like I was saying last night, he's the Monica Potter.
But Monica Potter never looked like Julia Roberts. It was only when you closed your eyes could you not tell them apart. She has Julia Roberts' voice. Julia Roberts' exact speaking voice.
But she had, like, their eyes. There were a lot of visual similarities as well.
I don't agree with that. But anyway, it stars him.
Emiyazi Coronaldi.
I don't know who that is.
She has been in a bunch of stuff. She was in...
Who does she play in The Invitation?
She's the girlfriend.
She's Logan Marshall Green's girlfriend.
Yeah.
Okay.
She was in Ava DuVernay's film Middle of Nowhere.
Okay.
And she's currently in Miles Ahead, which we have not seen yet.
Yes.
Tammy Blanchard.
Yes. And John Carroll Lynch.
John Carroll Lynch.
Yeah.
And this guy, Michelle Huisman.
I know that name.
He was on Game of Thrones. He was in Age of Adeline and Wild and World War Z.
Yeah.
Oh, and Black Book.
So anyway.
We're not telling you anything else.
Go into this as cold as you can. Don't read reviews if you can avoid them.
Yeah.
And pay attention while you're watching it.
Yeah.
Details count with this one. But it is fantastic.
Yeah.
It's so good. Now, here's what I want to do. A couple weeks from now, I would like you and I to record a little standalone.
What are we talking about? The Midnight Special and 15, The Invitation?
15, 30-minute additional. Where we talk about these movies, because I cannot stop thinking about The Invitation and all that it can mean. And the same thing with Midnight Special and what it could potentially really be about.
Okay.
In spite of its sci-fi sort of trappings. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so good.
The Invitation, anyway. And I know I'm in the minority on Midnight Special, so whatever. But I was with it, and then I was not with it at all, and just thought, "Are you S-ing me, movie?" So while you were watching Midnight Special this morning, I was watching The Boss.
Yeah.
I had missed the press screening for that.
Yeah.
And had been hearing just murderous reviews about it, and the fact that it's a reteaming of Melissa McCarthy and her husband
Ben Falcone
directing, And the two of them co-writing, as they did with Tammy, did not give me much enthusiasm because I really, really hated Tammy. And this movie definitely has big problems and definitely misuses a Melissa McCarthy character in the way that Tammy did in an Identity Thief.
Yep.
But along the way to it misusing that character, I did laugh substantially.
As did I.
So it's, you know, I think Melissa McCarthy operates much better in a universe where you have to meet her and she doesn't have to come to you and beg for your love.
Yep.
And this is one of those movies where she eventually has to like cry and beg for your love. And I much prefer her in something like Spy or Bridesmaids or The Heat, where she is unapologetically herself and everybody else just has to accustom themselves to her selfness.
I fully agree with you. I believe that Melissa McCarthy is a really gifted comic actor.
No question.
And is so astonishingly good at physical comedy.
Mm-hmm.
But even more than that, is great at digging in under the skin of grotesque characters. Now, she creates these characters.
Mm-hmm.
She created this character from The Boss. Didn't you just say
that? Yeah, she was a groundling character, yeah.
Yeah.
Who's like a motivational speaker who's basically like encouraging people to become wealthy. And of course, then this movie has to give her a backstory about how like she never had a family and that's why she pursues money instead. Because she preaches this thing about like, you know, you got to cut off all the dead weight and,
right.
and the power of one and stuff because, you know, everyone else is going to hold you back. And you can see where that's going.
I do know way back in the day in the Beverly Winwood Presents moment of the Groundlings that you and I went to a Groundlings night. And she performed a character that was very much like her character in Bridesmaids.
Yes.
And so that is...
That wasn't Beverly Winwood, though. That was an actual Groundling show that we went to, I remember, yeah.
Well, it was around the Gilmore Girls time.
Yes.
And so we... And by the way, she's back for the Gilmore Girls, which is very exciting. But the thing is that I hate it when a grotesque character has to become soft or warm or cuddly. I want that character to remain that character, even if they... Look, if you have to teach that person something, fine. Get it over with, rip the Band-Aid off real fast, and then let them continue on their path. Because if you do not, then...
You're mashing them. You're beating them basically by
you're taking the guts out of them.
Yeah, by the thing that the world wins. You know, we don't know what to do with you. You have to conform to us.
So there are some really cool things about her character in this movie. The outfits are mind blowing because every single one of them involves a turtleneck that goes so high that it cradles her head like an egg in a cup.
It's like she's wearing a traction collar.
Yeah.
There's so much turtleneck going on here.
And that is clearly her choice. She knows that that looks weird, and it's not even anything the movie calls attention to. That's how confident she is as a performer, and how how not vain she is in terms of like that teeth whitening scene, which is glorious. And so what you get in this film is a series of discrete moments, some of which are not funny at all, some of which are really funny.
Yeah.
And they're spread out among her and supporting cast like Cecily Strong,
Kristen Bell,
Tyler Labine. Kristen Bell does not get any funny moments.
No,
she's the straight man, and she has nothing to do.
Cedric Yarbrough. Annie Mumolo.
And so that is, like, there's a Girl Scout brawl that made my heart joyful.
It's
children beating the garbage out of each other.
It's kind of like the gang fights in the Anchorman movies, but with young girls, which is hilarious.
And so,
and actually, speaking of the Anchorman movies, it's a Gary Sanchez production, which is the Adam McKay, Will Ferrell company.
Yeah.
And I was saying to you afterwards, yeah, like, this is a character she created for Groundlings. And so this is, in a way, like those SNL movies where they take a wonderfully weird character and then have to build three acts around them and have to, like, they have to learn something and they have to become more human by the end. And who wants that?
No. They didn't make, what's the Anchorman character?
Ron Burgundy.
Ron Burgundy never had to learn anything.
No.
And although he wasn't a horrible human being like this character is, he was still oblivious. He was still obnoxious. He was still a sexual harasser. You know, he was a blowhard from the 1970s.
Yeah.
But he never had to ask for love. And this movie demands that she ask for love and cry, just like in Tammy.
Just like an Identity Thief.
Just like an Identity Thief. And it's maddening.
Yeah.
So this is a bad film. There's no real story to speak of.
Basically, she's hugely wealthy. She goes to jail for insider trading, loses everything, and then has to build her way back up with a scheme involving creating an offshoot Girl Scout thing where instead of selling cookies, they sell brownies, and the girls get to keep a cut of the action and, like, have a cut put into a college fund. Which is actually not a bad idea.
Right.
Just because, you know, the idea being that I mean, I'm sure the actual Girl Scout cookie money goes to good places, but the movie sort of presents it like that, you know, whatever profits the daffodils make goes to some other crappy thing, so it's pointless. Yeah, I mean, there's not much to it, and I think Wade Major said this is the kind of movie that, like, Bette Midler turned down in the 90s.
Yeah.
But there's something there, and McCarthy is so talented and so funny and has such a wild mind for this stuff. But and I think this is something that happens to men, too. I mean, like, when you think about, like, early Robin Williams movies and stuff, or even, like, Steve Martin, where they would have these bananas characters, but then eventually they had to, like, cry and ask for love, you know? And it's kind of galling.
Yeah.
It's anti-comedy, you know? I mean, when you look back at, like, the Marx Brothers never cried and asked for love, you know? Or the Three Stooges, or, you know, like, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, whatever. I mean, like, you know, you had characters that were bananas, and they got to stay bananas, and the world either had to capitulate to them or at least figure out a way to work them in.
Right.
You know, and this whole modern thing where they just, you take this anarchy and then channel it into Schmoopy Town.
Well, you send it to therapy. And basically, that is
boring.
Nothing funny about that.
Nope.
So, yeah. I wish it had been much, much, much better.
Yeah.
What else we got here? Louder Than Bombs.
Yeah.
This is
the English language debut of
Joachim Trier.
Right.
Now, he is a Norwegian filmmaker. His first movie was called Reprise, which I absolutely recommend.
Yes.
His second film was called Oslo, August 31st.
Which I also recommend.
Also highly recommend. And I was concerned that he was moving from Norwegian language films to English.
Because you sometimes, never know. Yeah. If when you're a director working in a language that is not your first language, you can get things wrong in terms of, it's harder to direct performances because you maybe aren't catching the nuance of language and how things are expressed. And then also when you have a film that is set in a country that is not your own, you don't always necessarily get the details right, or it becomes this outsider point of view whether you intended it to be or not.
Yes.
But neither of those things seem to be the case here.
No. Isabelle Huppert plays a photojournalist.
Like combat.
A combat photojournalist. Yeah. Who has died in a car accident. We learned that early.
Yeah.
Her family, and her performance is in flashback.
But she does pop up quite a bit.
Her husband, Gabriel Byrne, and her two sons, Jesse Eisenberg, and what's the other kids?
Devin Druid.
Devin Druid, that's the teenager in the movie.
Who's great.
He's great. They're all grieving in their own ways, and they They don't come to the conclusions that you think they might. They also don't wallow in despair the way you think they might, given this director. If you know this director's history,
Right. He's not afraid of.
he's not afraid to take you down the darkest road.
Yeah.
But this isn't exactly that.
Yeah.
And
In
so
this,
it's very
the
moving.
story kind of comes to a head because they're about to do a big gallery show of the dead mother's work. And a journalist who was very close to her and worked with her a lot, played by David Strathairn, is writing a piece about it for the New York Times, and he feels that he can't write about it without coming clean about the fact that even though she died in what was ostensibly a car accident, it was quite possibly and quite probably suicide.
Yeah.
And Gabriel Byrne knows it, and Jesse Eisenberg knows it,
The youngest
but
son does not.
Devin Druid does not know it, and it's this issue of like, do they tell him about it? Do they want to? His relationship with Gabriel Byrne has already been tricky because he's a teenage boy, and so this is just another thing to add on top of it,
There's go on.
No, the Jesse Eisenberg character has just become a father for the first time, but is clearly sort of ambivalent about it as he starts kind of taking up with an old girlfriend. And then there's this sort of unattainable girl that that Devin Druid is mooning over, who's played by the daughter from Nurse Jackie. And there's another teacher. Gabriel Byrne is a teacher at the high school where the younger son goes, and he's secretly having an affair with his son's English teacher, who's played by Amy Ryan. It's this is a movie about loss and about moving on. And it's you're right, it's a more hopeful movie necessarily, I think, than certainly than August Oslo August 31st. But what I like so much about Trier is that he can make films about characters who behave horribly and who are, they don't treat each other well, and they face the worst that life has to offer, and they don't always rise to the challenge of that. But there's still a strong sense of humanism about his work. Like you are compassionate with these characters, you understand the way they behave. You don't leave the theater hating them. You kind of you create a certain kind of empathy and it and understanding, and that sense of empathy, I think, deepens your own feeling about humanity, even though it came to you via very flawed characters doing things that are not good.
He rides this really great line between having a really healthy amount of chill kind of distance from the subject matter and being really generous and compassionate with his characters. And on top of all that, his films are impeccably shot.
I was going to say the cinematography
They're
is
beautifully
so
shot.
crisp, and shot by the same guy who shot his Norwegian films and then who also shot The End of the Tour. So there's a bit of an iciness to it, but there's also like there's a lengthy scene toward the end of the film that takes place against a sunrise that's just breathtaking.
And the title,
It's a Smiths album.
it is, yes. However, every Smiths album
Is something else.
is something else. There was a Canadian author named Elizabeth Smart. She born in 1913. She died in 1986. She wrote a prose poetry novel called By Grand Central Station, I Sat Down and Wept. And that's where Louder Than Bombs comes from. It comes from that book.
Do you have the line?
I do not.
Oh, okay.
But I do know that Morrissey, big fan
I see.
of her work.
Okay.
And that is the origin of that. It doesn't come directly from the Smiths, it comes via the Smiths
Right.
through Elizabeth
Well,
Smart.
I thought Only Lovers Left Alive was named for a Pet Shop Boys song, and it turns out the Pet Shop Boys song was named for a
Yes.
book. So
Yes.
what do I know?
So when this hits your territory, check this one out. You should.
Yeah, by all means.
Demolition.
A movie I liked more than you did,
Yeah.
which is rare.
Talk about
Usually
it.
Usually when we disagree about something, I didn't like it and you did. It's directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, who did Wild and, less successfully for me, the Dallas Buyers Club. Stars Jake Gyllenhaal as a young husband whose wife dies suddenly in a car accident. A lot of that going around this week. And he is married. You know, her father like runs the sort of mergers and acquisitions firm, whatever, you know, Wall Street-y thing where he
Did
works.
Did you say murders and acquisitions?
No, mergers and acquisitions. I think murders and acquisitions has been used as a title, though. It's a good one. And everyone is sort of gobsmacked by the fact that Gyllenhaal's character doesn't seem to be grieving or responding in a sort of rationally tragic way to this loss. The only outpouring of emotion he seems to express comes in these letters that he writes to the vending machine company. Because when he was in the ICU, you know, and his wife died, he put in $2 for a pack of M&Ms and they got stuck on the little hook on the way down. And so he keeps writing them these letters and goes into these very kind of lengthy explanations about his own life and about their relationship. And that's sort of the one kind of outward manifestation of, you know, his recognition of what's going on. And then the last thing that his wife had said to him before the truck plowed into their car was asking him to fix the drip in their refrigerator. And so he takes apart the refrigerator piece by piece and just stacks it on the floor and finds that that's something that is really purgative for him. So like, there's a squeaky door on a bathroom stall at work. He unscrews the entire, like, you know, all the stall walls. His computer on his desk is malfunctioning. He unscrews it, takes it all apart to a pile of pieces. And then he starts getting into bigger demolitions, and in the meanwhile strikes up a friendship with the woman at the vending machine company who is their customer service department, who was responding to his letters. And that's about as much as I'm going to say, but I think that it has a weirdly dark sense of humor for much of the film that reminded me of the early David O. Russell movies. And the fact that Naomi Watts plays the woman from the vending machine company, you know, kind of brings to mind I Heart Huckabees. But there was that same kind of like chilly absurdity and people behaving in a way that makes perfect sense to them, but to the world at large is completely mystifying. And I found it really kind of funny and unusual, and I liked Gyllenhaal's performance a lot. I think it does cop out at the end and it gets a little sappy. Where it had been fairly rigorous up until that point, and that frustrated me. But it, unlike Midnight Special, that was an ending turn that didn't completely take me out of the movie.
I believe there is a film about PTSD to be made that isn't so sort of archly stylized.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's what this is. I feel like his destruction of every single object around him, the literal destruction mm-hmm. of things around him, I think it's a really heavy-handed metaphor, I think, that it can only be enacted by a person who has no other concerns in life. You know, you don't tear apart your home with a sledgehammer unless you have a safety net somewhere. And so I want to see a movie about PTSD that is grounded in a sort of reality and not so concerned with giving me, you know, art directed grief. That's my problem.
Okay. See, I think you're thinking...
I don't think the emotional stuff pays off properly. Here's what I like. Gyllenhaal's performance is good.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing his best with this material and trying to give it truth. But I didn't feel it and I didn't see it.
I felt I was enough...
Other than when he was really going for it.
I was enough inside this guy's head that I didn't think about, oh, where's he going to sleep tonight? When he tears his own house down.
Yeah, well, that's a thing. I mean,
well, yeah, it is, but yeah. It's like, you know, that's I don't think that didn't get it in my way.
I'm gonna rent a bulldozer and put it right through the front of my house. Great. Now what?
Well, at that point, isn't
he already... What's your next plan, genius?
At that point, isn't he already sleeping on Naomi Watts' couch or something?
I don't remember.
Well, maybe you weren't paying enough attention to the movie then.
No, I paid very close attention.
Maybe the movie showed you where he was staying, and you
weren't staying with Amy. He was staying with Naomi Watts.
Okay,
then... You're right.
Meh.
Still.
Fine.
I found myself increasingly irritated and frustrated by everything that happened in this movie.
Well, this is a movie where if you're not on board, I could see where it would be just like, it would be annoying. But I was on board. And so to me, it worked until it didn't. There was that.
And I don't trust this filmmaker. I think that Wilde might be the blip on the radar that I really enjoyed. And I think that's because I firmly believe that Reese Witherspoon directed
Okay,
that
well,
film.
Here's the thing. This is his fourth feature.
Yeah.
Neither of us saw Crazy.
Nope.
Or Crazy.
Didn't.
We both didn't like Dallas Buyers Club. We both liked Wild, and we're split on this one. I think it's a little early to like decide that one of the three films that he saw, because you liked it, he didn't really make it.
Listen, do you think Reese Witherspoon doesn't take charge of everything she touches?
She does. Okay, fine. But then, so then is Hot Pursuit her fault?
Probably.
Probably. Let's be fair then.
It's probably.
Then
her fault.
The duds are also on her, if that's the thing.
It's probably.
If
her
she's
fault.
The auteur of her own career.
I'm willing to say that Hot Pursuit is probably her fault.
Well, jury's still out on this guy, so we'll see. And we should go back and watch his first film, too.
Okay, so Hardcore Henry.
Oh, yeah, which you saw and I did not, and I probably never will.
I don't see why you should.
It sounds like it would be a great short.
Well, funny thing you should say that.
Or was it already a great short?
Ilya, I'm blanking on his last name. One moment, please. I'm pulling up my review for therap.com.
Kuryakin?
No.
Little Man from U.N.C.L.E. reference there.
Boy, this sure is loading slowly. Just when I need it to load
quickly. Hang on. Ilya Naishuler.
Ilya Naishuler. First-time filmmaker. Russian. But I believe he lives in the U.K. And he's a music video director. And his style is this GoPro cam perspective. Mm. You strap the GoPro cam onto
your forehead.
Yourself. And
apply directly to forehead.
And now you are in a video game. So Henry, of the title, is played by no one. He is played by, as the credits say in the final credit roll, four additional cameramen.
Does he speak?
No.
I see.
He wakes up after an immense destructive accident. He's lost limbs. And he cannot remember anything, and he cannot speak. But in the time he was out, he was turned into a killing machine. He is being fit with bionic cyborgian prosthetic limbs by his girlfriend, who is a scientist.
His wife.
Sorry, his wife, who is a scientist, played by Haley Bennett. And... then a bad Russian dude breaks in and kidnaps her. And she says, Henry, engage. And so Henry engages. And he becomes, the Punisher and the Terminator and all the other killing machine people that have existed in film before. Although everything that happens, you see it through Henry's camera eyes.
Right. Video game style.
Video game style. And it is physically the most nausea-inducing experience that I have maybe ever had in the theater.
So more than Blair Witch, more than Cloverfield?
Oh, those two movies were made by Hu Hsiao-hsien.
They're Baylitar by comparison.
Compared to this, yeah. Like, this is... visual chaos, and honestly, it's plot chaos as well, because the plot details and character information is just so stingy. They distribute it in the tiniest little drips and drops because they don't care. Shoto Copley shows up playing Henry's sort of guide named Jimmy. Jimmy has a habit of getting killed over and over. You don't quite know why.
Or how he keeps coming back.
Or how he keeps coming back. But the film does, again, tiny bit by tiny bit, explain things to you and explains eventually by the end of the movie, you get why Henry has to go do these things, why he has to kill everything and everybody in his path. Now, there's a lot of really cool looking stuff in this movie. There are great killings, you know, inventive practical effects, some cool moments when things do slow down a little bit and you're sort of in the body of this person and like jumping across a building or something like that. There are some great explosions. There are some great decapitations. There are some great stabbings and self-surgeries and all sorts of just nutty stuff. But it does not add up to a story because no one bothered.
They don't care. Yeah. They don't care.
And it's not only is it the kind of movie that if you have any sort of tendency toward motion sickness, you should avoid this at all costs. I found myself more than a couple times having to look at the exit sign of the theater because that is a fixed spot
on the horizon,
not moving. And just sort of watch the movie out of my peripheral just to avoid getting nauseated. Which Matt actually sat right next to me, who sat right next to Christy, who sat right next to Ben.
Right.
And Whitney was on my other side. And Matt had his hand over his eyes like much of the movie.
On What the Flick this week, they all sort of reported a certain degree of nausea, which of course then all of the YouTube commenters like, y'all are old, y'all don't understand.
That is not about being young or old.
Well,
this is, and I know that the cinema scores were based.
Yeah, the cinema scores under 18 was A minus and over 50 was an F.
Yeah.
Here's the problem. If you grew up playing these video games,
then the motion is not a problem for you.
Yeah.
That's fine.
That's what I'm talking about.
The motion sickness is the least of this movie's problems.
I see.
I did not grow up playing first-person shooter games, and I do have a tendency toward motion sickness. I cannot get on amusement park rides, even mild ones.
True.
If you spin me around, I'm going to puke.
Like a record, baby.
And so, and that's been my whole life since childhood. But the problem with this movie is not the camera whipping you around. The problem with this movie is that it's about nothing. And it is of the mistaken belief that sensation can give you everything you need. You do need more than that.
Sure.
The sensations in this film, the violence is, for me, delightful. Because you know I love extreme violence in a film. I love creative death in a film.
Which is why...
And there were moments where I, as crazy deaths were happening, I was like, whoa, ha-ha, yay! You know, like, but that's...
Well, that's why I was saying that I think it would make a good short. You know, they're onto something as far as finding a new way to tell a story, and then they just realize they didn't bother to actually tell one.
No, there is nothing.
Is what it sounds like.
There's nothing. And I know it's been being accused of being misogynist, but it is actually no more misogynist than it is simply anti-human. Because not just the women die. Almost everyone dies.
But the men who die are gangsters and the women who die are whores, right?
Yeah. So, you know, take your pick.
Yippee.
Yeah, it's bad. Okay. It is a bad movie. Honestly, it's a lot like The Boss because there's a lot in it that if you show it to me, I'll go woohoo, you know.
But ultimately,
it's just a terrible film.
Gotcha.
And yeah, proud of my line in my rap review. The movie-going equivalent of riding the Vominator at a knockoff Soviet Six Flags. It takes place in Moscow. That's why.
We had an interesting movie adventure yesterday.
We sure enough did.
So the Belgian filmmaker Chantal Akkerman died last year, and there is a big retrospective of her works. I don't know if it's a complete retrospective or a nearly complete retrospective, but a lot of her films that are being shown. Yeah. They're doing it in Los Angeles, and they're doing it in New York. And here they're splitting it out over several different venues. Some of the screenings are at Red Cat downtown, some are at Human Resources, and some are happening at Cinefamily, which, you know, is in our neighborhood and we like to go there. And Cinefamily was hosting a screening of Golden 80s. And I remember when Akkerman died, reading some obit, John Powers or somebody who just made in passing mention, oh yeah, her 1980s mall musical. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? Chantal Akkerman's 1980s mall musical? Where is this movie and when can I see it?
Exactly.
It was never really released in the United States. But when I heard about this retrospective, I started combing the listings. And indeed, there we go. Cinefamily was showing Golden 80s. So we bought our tickets, got our seats on the sofa. Like, we did it up big time. And we get there, and it's a packed house. Obviously, a lot of other people wanted to see the Chantal Akkerman 1980s mall musical, which was co-written by this odd mix of folks, including this guy who wrote, like, Jacques Rivette's Paris Belongs to Us, Leora Barish, who wrote Desperately Seeking Susan, Henry Bean, who wrote The Believer and wrote another Akkerman film called A Couch in New York, which is a comedy with Juliette Binoche and William Hurt. So, you know, we're all psyched to see this movie, and the movie starts, and, you know, the credits end, and there's this woman, and she kisses one guy and says, "Je t'aime," and then she turns and kisses this other guy and says, "Je t'aime." And then, you know, she walks down the stairs and starts talking to her friend and blah, 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 French. And there's no subtitles. And it, after about three or four lines of dialogue,
I started laughing.
You can sense in the audience, everybody's like, oh no. Oh no. And obviously there were quite a few people there who were Francophones. And so they were fine, you know.
Right.
But, you know, you saw, like, people getting up and going to the lobby, and there was some rustling about. So then after the first song ends, they stop the film, and they bring the lights up, and they're like,
we're sorry.
Sorry, we got this 35mm print from Belgium, but we didn't check it, and,
Yeah, that's, okay, if I'm going to gripe about anything.
They didn't run it through.
Why
once.
Didn't they run it through?
I thought with the 35 you always do. Did that. Yeah, you never,
I mean, that's my understanding. You run it through,
yeah,
right?
Just to make sure that you got the right print and nothing else. You know. But they were very nice about it. And they were like, if you want to leave, we'll give you your money back and a pass to come back. And, you know, we obviously said we are committing to bring this movie back with subtitles. And yep. We'll project soft titles onto it if we have to. You know. Cinefamily was very cool about it. No patch on them.
No.
And so Dave turns to me and goes, let's stay. And I said, yeah, sure.
I just want to look at it.
Exactly. I want to see this thing. And because it's a musical. And so we can pretty much probably figure out what's going on. As we told a friend about it later, he goes, well, Dave, you like the opera and you don't know what's going on in those half the time. Although all operas have titles now, right?
They do. They have super titles above the screen. Yeah.
So we stayed and we watched Golden 80s in French. And it was really interesting and a lot of fun. It's, you know, calling it a mall musical is stretching it a bit. It's basically a clothing store, a hair salon, like a coffee bar, and a movie theater.
A cinema
that was showing something called Green Ice.
Which is a Ryan O'Neal and Archer film from like 1981.
Okay, because I think there were two different Green Ices. I thought like one of them was like a sci-fi movie.
I looked it up.
Oh, so it was that one. Yeah. Okay, fine. So it was showing Green Ice, but then they also had posters up for the 1940s Gun Crazy, which is a great movie.
With lobby cards that didn't match.
Well, they were in color, but it was not uncommon for black and white movies to have lobby cards in color.
Yeah, but they were like a Western
movie. Oh, really? Oh, I didn't notice. Yeah. Okay. And then they, at one point,
I think they were hoping we wouldn't notice.
I see. Yeah. And then at one point, they had a big poster up for the 1960s Batman movie with Adam West.
Right.
It was a really cool poster, the Belgian or French or whatever poster that was.
Yeah.
So the drama as it is about the son of the people who own the clothing store, and like there's three different women in the salon who are in love with him, or two,
I three.
Guess. Three, yeah. And then
I only know this because I read a synopsis after the film.
And then this guy shows up who's lived in America for 30 years, and it turns out that back in the day he was in love with the mother, the woman who owns the clothing store, but now she's...
Played by Delphine Seyrig,
who was in Ackerman's Jean Dielman.
Jean Dielman.
She was also in Last Year at Marienbad. You know, and so she's trying to figure out, does she leave her husband and son to go off with the guy she really loved? There, the father has a long conversation with the son, and I wasn't quite sure who he was trying to get the son to marry, but one of the few lines of where my high school French came in, the father says something along the lines of, and then I married your mother. So like the idea being like, you know, yeah, there's the woman you love when you're young, but then you marry responsibly, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Yeah, it was nice. and very, you know.
When I finally get to see it with subtitles, yes. and I can know more what's going on.
And what's being said.
And what.
And Ackerman also wrote all the lyrics to the songs.
Whose story is being told and why? That's what I want to know. And I want to know the content of the songs. And it was wonderful to look at. I picked up, you know, a lot of visual things with no choice.
That was all there was.
But to look at that, I want to talk about this again when we finally get to see it.
Yeah,
yeah.
But there's a lot of musical numbers inside the hair salon, which reminded me of Earth Girls Are Easy and Venus Beauty
and
Institute.
Venus Beauty Institute, yeah, which is like from 2001.
Yeah, it's in my Christmas book, actually.
It was a lovely movie, by the way.
Also kind of reminded me of Eight Women a little. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's this fun sort of like, because the music is all sort of, even though it's made in the 80s, there's a bit of a 60s kind of yeah flavor to a lot of it. But yeah, it was charming. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing it again with a full translation involved, but that's just kind of a cool LA experience. Go see a French movie and it's in French and you better follow along or not or whatever. But I think it's interesting to watch a movie in a language you don't speak without subtitles, because it really does kind of force you to look at the visual storytelling. And I was reminded of the time that I was in Berlin for the film festival, and some independent theater in the former East Berlin was screening Billy Wilder's 1-2-3, which is a comedy that's all about the Berlin Wall. And I thought, well, I can't not see this movie in East Berlin.
Yeah.
So I go see it with my friend Clark, who lives in Berlin and who speaks fluent German. And then our friend Pani, who was there with me, and she speaks no German at all and had never seen the movie. And the three of us went and laughed all the way through it. Clark got everything that was being said. I remembered it from having seen it before in English. And Pani just responded to just the visual, you know, the slapstick and the way the characters bark at each other in a Billy Wilder movie. It was very funny. So, I think it's an interesting, like, you know, get a DVD of a foreign film you've never seen and turn off the subtitles and just see how much of it you can glean from looking at it and how much the director is telling a story without words.
So I have a DVD recommendation.
Okay.
Venus Beauty Institute.
Oh, all right.
It is available.
Good.
In fact, there are some very cheap copies. If you just want to buy it, you can get it for like under $5 on a variety of from a variety of sources. This is a really sweet film about women who work in a beauty salon.
Yeah.
In Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Came out 2001.
Stars a very young Audrey Tautou. Like,
yes.
I think she won a César for like breakthrough performance.
Yeah.
It was her first big movie.
And if you know your world cinema well enough, you will catch the cameo of Claire Denis.
Oh, really?
Great director Claire Denis as a woman who comes to the salon for a beauty treatment.
Funny.
Yeah.
No, I didn't know about that.
But just wonderful, lovely, sort of full of life,
yes,
and goodness.
Very compassionate and funny. And
yeah.
Yeah, I love that movie. My DVD pick this week is The Lady in the Lake, which, like Hardcore Henry, is told entirely with the camera as the first person. Robert Montgomery plays, I'm blanking now, Philip Marlowe, thank you. Famous detective. I knew it was one of them. It plays Philip Marlowe. And it was the last movie he made at MGM, I believe, and the first movie that he directed. And he's barely in it because the camera is Philip Marlowe. So everyone is talking to him, and you hear him speak. And occasionally he passes in front of a mirror or something and you see Robert Montgomery. But for the most part, it's all being directed at you. And it was the first movie to be shot that way, or first feature film anyway. And the gimmick might wear out from time to time. And at the beginning of the movie, Robert Montgomery gives you this whole speech about how, like, you know, you can solve this mystery. We're showing you all the clues. And not exactly. But it's very entertaining. And again, and also in my Christmas book, strangely enough.
There is a split second in Hardcore Henry when Hardcore Henry is sprinting past these people in an apartment, and their wall of their living room is covered with movie posters. And one of the posters is of old vintage Lady in the Lake poster.
Funny. Yeah.
And it, seriously, if you blink, you...
if you're looking at the exit sign, you might miss it.
And if you're one of those under 18s who gave it an A-plus cinema score, you might not know
the reference.
The reference.
So go see Lady
in
the Lake.
It ain't like this is the first time anyone's made a movie like this.
Yeah.
So everybody calm down.
We have letters.
Dynamoxy. Hello, all. I sit here debating whether it is worth anyone's time for me to write you an email regarding my personal relationship with the Venture Brothers. Wait, this is an LKTV letter.
Oh, that's right. Sorry, the Venture Brothers conversation was on LKTV. Sorry.
Why did you send that to me?
I failed again.
Yeah, you sure did. Hang on. I'm going
to... I'll save it and I'll resend it to you. Don't worry.
Okay, thank you.
You are not to be trusted.
This is from Brent. David Alonso, been sick with the flu this past week, and I went on an archive binge. This inspired me to try and come up with my own top 10 list for knifing. This is not quite my favorite of all time. There is a theme that I won't spoil, but will be obvious by the time you reach number one. 90% of the listeners will probably figure out by number seven. You know what? Here's the thing. I haven't looked at this list yet. You're giving me too much credit. Let's see if I can figure out this. Don't blurt it out if you know the theme, Alonzo.
Okay.
Number 10, Boogie Nights.
Mm-hmm.
Number 9, Watchmen.
Mm-hmm.
Which we didn't really like all that much. Number 8, Kinsey.
Yeah,
great. Number movie. 7, American Gigolo.
Yes.
Number 6, The Pillow Book.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, totally.
Number 5, The Piano.
Mm-hmm.
Number 4, The Fisher King.
Okay.
Number 3, Trainspotting.
Yeah.
Number 2, Brokeback Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Number 1, The Crying Game.
Yeah. Do you not get what the theme is?
No. I don't, honestly.
Dong.
What?
Visible penises. Read them out again.
Oh. You're right. How many of these are Ewan McGregor? Two of them, at least.
Trainspotting and Pillow Book. Yeah, Young Adam didn't make the list.
You don't actually see anyone's real penis in Boogie Nights.
Right. It's a fake.
That's a fakie. Here's my fondest memory from Boogie Nights. I saw it with Pete and his wife, Catherine.
And me, right?
Was it with you, too?
Yeah, in Dallas.
Were you there, too?
Yeah. At the movie mall.
Movie's over. First thing Pete says to me. You ever seen one that big? Bet you never seen one that big before, have you? And I was like, yeah, I totally have. In real life. Yes, I have. More than once. I don't know what you people are thinking is so great about it, but I've seen that kind of thing before.
That's the thing about Boogie Nights that loses me. Like, they spend the entire movie talking about how amazingly gifted Dirk Diggler is. And then when you finally see it, it's like,
that's
whatever.
So many guys in porn are basically like that. Yeah. Whatever. But I like the movie.
I'll give that a 90, I'd say. We're not going to give you Watchmen.
I'm down for everything but Watchmen. You're 90% knife, Brett. Woo-hoo. Thanks for all the peens. Oh, hey. Honorable mention, Cachorro. keep up the good work, Brent. P.S. Because of listening to the Exile in Guyville audiobook, which is for sale via PayPal, for whatever you want to buy it for.
exileinguyvillebook.tumblr.com.
Or just email us at our... Just go to PayPal, and we're linoleumpodcast@gmail.com at PayPal. It's for sale for whatever you want to pay.
Yeah.
$1?
$1,000?
$1,000? I have an odd desire to see Alonzo in a fez.
Ha ha ha.
Okay. Alexander. Dear Alexander says, Dear Alonzo and Dave, I'm the guy who tweeted at Alonzo about shouting holy F during the last scene of The Clan and recommended Jia Zhengke's feature debut, Pickpocket, on Twitter. After some research, I discovered that Pickpocket is no longer in circulation, although I'm sure it's on YouTube. I discovered Linoleum Knife through What the Flick, which I discovered through Ebert Presents.
Ah, okay.
Funny enough, I often found myself siding with Christie on Ebert Presents, siding with Alonzo on What the Flick, and siding with Dave on Linoleum Knife. I'm curious, is there a filmmaker that one of you loves that the other detests? Or more broadly, is there a movie that one of you would consider an all-time great that the other would never watch again? Well, you hate Harmony Korine.
I was going to say Harmony.
And I think he's really great.
I was going to say Harmony Korine, but I liked
Spring Breakers.
So that sort of broke the curse. I now can only say that I dislike most Harmony Korine movies. But yeah, I don't, you know, I've still never seen a Bresson movie, so, you know, that's anybody's guess. And
well, that's where our new our new feature is going to come in.
Oh yes.
We're going to finally, we've been talking about this for years, literally like 2, 3, 4 years, that we should have a thing that we call Make Me.
Yeah.
Where you make me watch something that I've never seen that mm-hmm. you've been dying for me to watch, and right. I make you watch something that you've never seen because you need it.
Uh-huh.
And so get ready.
You too.
I don't know if there's an all-time great that he loves that I would never watch again. I know you like Gigi. I don't know that you're going to say that's one of your all-time greats.
I like it.
But boy, do I hate that one.
I find it charming. You are not into it. I know.
Is there anything you can think of that I've said was a perfect near masterpiece that you...
No, usually just the movies that you, there's a movies that you are into that I just think, I don't want to see that. I don't want to watch The Touring Horse. I don't want to see anything by Matthew Barney. No, life's too short. I don't want to. I probably should, but I don't want to.
I'm mostly writing because I want to submit two lists to be knifed. Oh, do you? First up, my 10 favorite films from the last 10 years.
Okay.
Another Year.
Yeah.
Which is great. Mm-hmm. Bernie.
Yeah.
Francis Ha.
Yeah.
The Interrupters, which I haven't seen it,
but I hear good things.
Like Father, Like Son, the Hirokazu Koreeda film, not the Kirk Cameron Dudley Moore film. I have also not seen Like Father, Like Son.
Nor have I.
I've seen Sokurov's Father and Son, which is fantastic.
Oh, right. No, yeah. Different one.
Listen Up, Philip.
Yeah.
Lust, Caution. He says, I know most people detest this film, but I had so much fun recommending this to my friends whose familiarity with Ang Lee was limited to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, or Sense and Sensibility. I also think it has two of the greatest performances of the last 10 years.
I mean, I remember my joke being that, like, the Mahjong sequences in that movie were my favorite parts, because that was sort of like where the women were really kind of, you know, playing politics and whatnot. I remember not being super into it, but it's been so long since I've seen it, I don't really remember why.
A Separation.
Mm-hmm.
Timbuktu.
Haven't seen it, but I hear it's good.
A Touch of Sin. It's sitting on the stack over there.
Timbuktu is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, between ones we like and ones we haven't seen, that's
100% knife, dude.
I'll let you have less caution if you're that
excited. Okay, let's give him his next list. His 10 favorite films of all time.
Okay.
The Blue Kite.
Didn't see it.
I haven't seen it. Yeah. There are certainly more significant films from the Chinese fifth generation, Raise the Red Lantern, Farewell My Concubine, Zhu Du. But, oh, by the way, all three of those
are great.
But this remains my absolute favorite and probably the least seen of those films. I have not seen it. I actually wrote about the fifth generation for my college senior thesis. And now I work in IT sales because, as you can imagine, a BA in international studies with a thesis on fifth generation filmmaking in China did not automatically translate into gainful employment.
Doors weren't flying open for you?
Breaking the Waves.
Mm. There's a movie that people love that I hate.
Yeah. City of Sadness.
Didn't see it.
Shoshin. The Ice Storm. Mm. In the Loop.
Yeah.
In the Mood for Love.
Yeah.
2046.
Yeah.
North by Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
Tokyo Story.
Yeah.
Topsy Turvy.
Mm-hmm.
That's a...
95% knife.
Haven't seen Blue Kite, but yeah, you're 95%. Yeah. Thanks, guys. Keep up the great podcasting, Alex. Thank you for
Thank you.
Liking great movies, Alex.
Yeah. You're way ahead of me on the whole China thing.
Renee. Hi, David Alonso. On last week's episode, you talked about how some commenters accused you of being too gay to review certain movies, whatever that means. Was that you?
Yeah, remember I talked about how, like, the for certain genres of film, and the weird one was when people said I was too gay to appreciate Les Miserables.
Right, yeah, yeah. This reminded me of a funny anecdote from a few years ago. The IOC was trying to decide whether to continue including wrestling as an Olympic sport. Of course, this upset countries like Turkey and Russia, where wrestling is considered quite manly. I remember reading a quote from some Russian wrestling coach who accused the IOC of bowing to an international gay conspiracy who wanted wrestling banned because it is, quote, too masculine.
Honey, if anything, the gays want to keep the wrestling in the Olympics for sure.
I would vote to keep wrestling in the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
This comment is especially ludicrous when juxtaposed with, for instance, Vladimir Putin and Gerard Depardieu rubbing their noses together while they look each other in the eyes. No homo. Thank you, Renee.
There's one other Venture Brothers letter in there, so skip it. I've saved it also, and I'll resend it to you for LKTV.
Hey, David Alonso. My name is Clay Bloodworth. I am a 17-year-old, longtime fan of the podcast who lives in Pensacola. Wanted to thank you two for introducing me to countless films that I most likely wouldn't have seen without your strong recommendations. New movies, yes, but even older stuff you guys have recommended are things I've ended up loving. I believe you were the first to mention Weekend, the Andrew Haig film, which I've seen a few times now and absolutely adore. More recently, Finders Keepers was a great watch, but the guy that finds the foot?
Yeah, in the grill.
Yeah. Therefore, I wanted to share some of my favorite overlooked and underseen films of 2015. These are movies that I enjoyed greatly, but I didn't hear others talk about that often. I would recommend to any moviegoer seriously interested in film. Would love to hear it if you guys have seen and or agree with my picks. Buzzard.
Never even heard of that one.
Dixieland.
I didn't see that.
Queen of Earth. I missed Queen of Earth.
Queen of Earth was pretty amazing. It's for the follow-up from the guy who did Listen Up, Philip. I didn't know that it held together completely all the way to the end, but it totally worth seeing for Elizabeth Moss's performance.
5-star.
Oh, that was the hotel movie. We didn't see that one.
Well, it was called 5-Star Life, right?
Unless 5-Star is a different movie, maybe. I don't know.
Is 5-Star the biopic of the British pop group 5-Star?
I think probably not. We'll have to look that up.
They had hits.
In England?
One over here, but I can't remember now what it was called.
Oh, okay.
Creep?
What was Creep?
Cop Car?
I didn't see Cop Car.
Meet the Battelles?
Jesus, Clay in Pensacola saw all the movies, because I didn't... I just
Z for Zachariah?
I saw that one! I saw that one!
Meadowland?
Didn't...
Digging for Fire?
I did not like that one. That was the Duplass movie that was set in that house. The people are house-sitting for the weekend, and they start digging, and they find, like, a bone and a gun.
Manglehorn.
Loved it.
Guess what? I haven't seen any of these.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
I saw Z for Zachariah and quite liked it. I did not care for Digging for Fire. I loved Manglehorn. I think that's like the best contemporary Al Pacino performance. Again, David Gordon Green. And I think in my review I said after this and Nicolas Cage and Joe, he's the ham whisperer. Because he actually got them to sort of turn in these really sort of subdued and powerful performances. Yeah, good on you, Clay. You are keeping up with the smaller indies better than we have, apparently. So yeah, even if I didn't like Digging for Fire, you're still 100% knife for your due diligence, because you're making us look lazy.
This is from Mint, who has written to the show before. Mm. Dear Alonso and Dave, I loved your reviews of the God's Not Dead films.
Mm.
As a religious person, one of those kindly Lutheran types you mentioned, I found the ending of the first God's Not Dead to be one of the most insulting endings in religious cinema. Well, you're right.
Yeah.
I just wanted to share a different experience with apologetics than the ones these films propagate and the one you described from your growing up experience, Dave, and why I find evangelical Christianity infuriating. The apologetics I grew up with weren't about evidentiary proof. It was learning how to answer the question, why do you believe, in a situation where you can have a calm conversation about it. Instead of assuming the place of being persecuted when someone asks that question, it's about being able to speak about your faith in a constructive, reasonable, and ultimately non-argumentative way. To me, it's just like being able to explain why I like a movie without saying another person is wrong for not liking that same movie. It's a way of approaching conversation rather than debate, and it's something I wish conservative evangelical Christianity would figure out. Mint, they are not going to. That is simply not going to happen. Anyway, thanks for the great show. As always, I never feel attacked as a person of faith listening to y'all, and that's honestly a really great comfort.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Also, I finally settled on a top 10 of 2015, which I've listed below. My knife prediction is 80 to 85%.
Wow. Okay. Well,
here we go.
Try us.
Black Hat.
Boo. Pardon me. That's five off right
is
there.
Is that a hiccup? I'm going to give it to you.
Yeah, you would.
Here's why. I didn't like it. But I think I might be wrong, first of all. And secondly, because I've never disliked a Michael Mann movie. Also, I really want to see that recut. The Martian.
Yeah.
Ex Machina.
Yeah.
Sicario.
Mm-hmm.
Best of Enemies.
Yeah.
Mistress America.
Totally.
Steve Jobs.
Okay.
It was good.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Good-ish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Magic Mike XXL.
Mm.
Which was really good.
I didn't care for it all that much, but whatever. I don't hate it. I just... Whatever. Go on.
Actually, Magic Mike XXL, Carol, and Creed are all tied for number one.
Huh. Okay. Yeah.
Sincerely, Mint. P.S. I feel Cenk Uygur's mannerisms are rubbing off on Alonso.
Of course!
His imitation of frustrated, persecuted Christians was perfectly Cenk.
Maybe I'm rubbing off on Cenk. Don't tell HR.
This is from John.
Mm-hmm.
David Alonso, consider this email semantic food for thought.
Ooh.
Recent talk about the homoerotic aspects of Pee-wee's Big Holiday and Everybody Wants Some has made me reflect on a term that I have heard in the realm of academia. I know where he's going. And I wish was more commonplace as it could have a positive effect on culture. That term is homosocial.
Hmm. Go on.
As I predicted. Which, as you may know, means of, comma, relating to, comma, or involving social relationships between persons of the same sex and especially between men. We live in a culture that has issues with acknowledging that men can have any sort of non-sexual yet friendly or affectionate with other men. Where is this sentence going? I think he left out a word. Non-sexual yet friendly relationship or affection with other men as a result of homophobia and toxic ideas about masculinity.
Absolutely.
Conversely, there is a paradoxical tendency for others to deem any homosocial relationship as homosexual.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So much so that there are fathers who aren't sure about hugging their sons.
Yes.
If homosocial were ubiquitous, then I think there would be more of an implicit, neutral acknowledgement of how men relate to each other, either sexually or non-sexually, which could then tamp down on cultural homophobia. Or the notion of homosociality provides... Sorry, I'm spitting out the words. Or the notion of homosociality provides a hermeneutic basis for which homosexuality or homoeroticism may be understood and widely accepted.
You lost me at hermeneutic.
No, okay. No, you know that word. Pee-wee's Big Holiday and Everybody Wants Some can be seen as homoerotic, but I think the more valuable thing about both movies is how they both portray homosociality in a matter of fact, chill manner. Sure, there's a strong suggestion that Pee-wee has unrealized romantic or sexual feelings for Joe Manganiello, He spells it correctly.
Oh.
I'm just
you're doing the way Pee-wee
I'm
did,
doing the bit. Yeah. But a little boy could watch the movie and see a positive representation of a man or boy man becoming friends with another man.
Mm.
The same goes for how a teenage boy could view Everybody Wants Some. Yet I also hope that teenage boys don't see the movie as an automatic boys will be boys vindication of their own sexism. But boys, you know the rest. I'm probably preaching to the choir on this one, but I think it bears mentioning.
That too.
John, P.S. Regarding your Patreon subscription, my partner would like to know how much it costs to subscribe at the level in which she could meet with you guys and eat pie. Or she could eat pie and you guys could eat whatever dessert you prefer. I'm open to pie all the time, every day.
We'll work something out.
Yeah, well, no, absolutely right. I believe that Pee-wee's Big Holiday has elements of homoeroticism. Legit homoeroticism.
Sure, in the same way that, like, in the Christmas special where you've got, like, the hunky shirtless workers making a wall out of fruitcake, you know, or any appearance of Ricardo.
Right. I also believe that the homosocial does play a role in Pee-wee's Big Holiday.
Sure.
I don't believe that homoeroticism exists in Everybody Wants Some. I believe that is a firmly homosocial experience.
Right.
If you are seeing it homoerotically, it is because you are gay and those guys all are wearing good shorts and have cool mustaches.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think definitely in the case of Everybody Wants Some, it is homosocial, but from without to the, in the male gaze,
right,
it is homoerotic.
Yeah, as those guys are G-A-Z-E. very going, as those heterosexual characters are going about their business, gay men are watching them.
Right.
And enjoying it.
Yes.
On an entirely different level than the film necessarily
is consciously delivering. Although right. I think, even at some point, I think Linklater
knows.
Linklater is having fun with it, but he's not playing it up in any way, I don't think. Yeah.
Oh, look, it's from Pilar. Pilar Duralde.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, guys. I know it's not cool to have family write to you.
She's my niece.
Since we're supposed to be supportive as family members, blah, blah, but I am an actual fan with a list for you to knife.
Well, all right then.
Here's my top 10 list of women / girls coming of age. Top 10 movies about women under 30, or just top 10 movies with a female lead.
Okay.
Frances Ha.
Yeah.
Chungking Express.
Oh, so good.
Seriously, along with Safe and Happiness.
Your favorite film of the 90s?
Favorite movies of the 90s. Mm. Yeah. Diary of a Teenage Girl.
Mm-hmm.
Heathers.
Yeah.
It's a classic.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the Dollhouse.
Sure.
Incredible. Pariah.
Yeah.
Hannah.
All right. I was not the giantest fan of that movie.
I really enjoyed Hannah.
There's some good stuff, and I like her performance a lot.
Daisies.
I still need to see Daisies.
Yeah.
Okay, now I'm embarrassed because my niece has seen Daisies and I haven't watched it yet. So.
The Witch.
Okay, yeah.
Juno.
All right, yeah.
You know, even though you're family, you get 100%.
Yeah, despite that, we'll let it go. But we have so many other films on that list of that ilk to show you, though.
This is from Russell.
Okay.
Hey, you cool cats. Your podcast pulls off the miracle of being both populist and pretentious. Well done. And in tribute to the words podcast, populist, and pretentious, I submit to your knifing my 10 favorite films in no order, starting with the letter P.
Brought to you by the letter P.
Playtime.
Oh, great.
Petulia.
Love it.
Point Blank.
Yeah.
He's got notes in here, too, but we got too many letters.
Okay, okay, okay.
I'm sorry, Russell. Persona.
Mm-hmm.
Privilege.
Have not seen Privilege, but I heard
of it. I haven't either.
I know of it.
The Passenger.
Oh, yeah.
Pather Panchali.
Mm-hmm.
Peeping Tom.
Yeah.
Possession.
Which I've also not seen, but I need to. That's that nutty...
Yeah, Isabella Gianni.
Yes, and Sam Neill movie.
So great. Pick up on South Street.
Mm-hmm.
Honorable mentions. Performance. Mm-hmm. Pure LeFou.
Mm-hmm.
Pickpocket.
Mm-hmm.
Phantom Carriage.
Mm-hmm.
Paths of Glory.
Mm-hmm.
Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
Mm-hmm.
Passion of Joan of Arc.
Mm. May I recommend Parting Glances? I'm just throwing that out there.
May you?
It was just the first movie you? That I thought of.
May I recommend The Phantom Toll Booth?
Your P list is 100% knife.
Hey, speaking of P's, I need to go to the Patreon and pay. Pronto. See what I did there? Yours honorably, Uncle Rusty.
Thank you.
Do we call you Rusty or Russell?
Uncle Rusty, apparently.
What's it going to be? This is from Seth.
Mm.
Seth, if you remember, is one of my Wendy Williams bros.
Ah. Is he the one who went to the show?
He's the guy who went to the show and got on camera with Ask Wendy.
Oh, well, that was an LKTV letter, so yeah. Our regular LK audience might not know that.
But here we go. Velvet Goldmine is amazing.
Mm.
It is. It holds a special place in my heart because it took a friend of mine who had just moved to New York City from Kansas. This was her first movie in New York, and it really opened her eyes to amazingness. Plus, Christian Bale and Ewan McGregor having sex on a British rooftop while glitter pours down. How can anything match that? So, yeah. Those are all the letters. There sure were a lot of letters this
there
week.
Were indeed. I forgot something real quick. One moment. I wanted to thank Pelly Helper, Collider Mania, Rough Cart Kevin, Blood Clay, and Man Fan for leaving us nice reviews on iTunes.
Thanks, Man Fan.
Because that's how people find the show. The more reviews we get, the better placement we get on the iTunes chart of all the many, many, many movie podcasts. And so the good reviews do help us get seen by more folks. Also want to thank Neon Ronin, Andrew White, Ginger J, and Allison Jones, and SJH Canada, and Dylan Brandesma, and Matthew Flores for tweeting about the show and letting people know about it.
Nice.
So, thank you. That's it helps get the word out there. We are small potatoes, but you guys...
But we're Yukon gold.
But you guys irrigate the fields. And let the world know that we exist, so we appreciate that. Another way to support the show, of course, is to join our club over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/linoleumknife,
yep.
Where you get LKTV and lots of extra goodies.
For cheap money.
If you are a fan of this program. So, we thank you if you've already done it, and if you haven't, we hope you are able to do so soon. It helps us a lot. But in any event, thanks for listening again this week, and check out our friends on the internet. Go to christylemire.com. Listen to the Rotten Tomatoes podcast with Matt and Gray, the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney, The Schmoes Know, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Joel Ryan Thing, The Sewers of Paris, The Bret Easton Ellis podcast, the Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Game Night Guys, Film Spotting SVU, and Secretly Timid. Thanks to Blue, as always, for our great theme music. Go to Blutopia.com and check out information about Johnson & Macaulay, which is his latest project. They're doing some performances in LA and some other cities, so you'll want to find out more about that. Blutopia. In addition to iTunes, where you can subscribe for free, you can stream this show at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com. Go like our Facebook page. We are going to try and start doing some more Facebook Live happenings at some point, either as we're setting up the podcast or maybe like when we're coming out of movies or whatever, just to sort of be out there live on the internet and taking questions and stuff. Follow us.
Looking at you in the face and a camera. Situation.
It'll be fine. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LinoleumCast. If you are not a Patreon member, you can still purchase a la carte our Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episodes. Our latest is Die Hard, but we've got a bunch of other ones, and we are currently working on 2 Days, 1 Night, which we'll be doing later this month. You can PayPal us $1.99 each for those at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know where to send it and which one you want. Had a couple orders this week for Josie and the Pussycats, because that movie just celebrated its 15th anniversary, and I posted an article about that.
People are giving a little more respect
Yeah.
than they did before.
Folks are coming around. And yeah, you can always drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions, comments, top 10 lists, whatever. We love hearing from you. And, you know, we're actually caught up on our letters after doing an all letter episode recently. So the mailbag is a little empty. Fill her up, why won't you?
Didn't I say last week, if we've never heard from you?
Right, yes.
We want to know who you are.
Yes.
Like, we hear from some regular folks.
Mm-hmm.
And
rather, we hear from folks regularly.
You know what I mean. And, but I know there are folks out there who've never talked to us.
Yes.
Who've never written in, never, and you don't have to have a list. Frankly, if all of you have lists, it just takes longer to read the letter.
But yeah, the ratio of letters we get to people who actually download and listen to this show is a pretty wide one.
Yeah, it's small. And so here's my thing. I'm just curious. Like, who are you?
How did you find us?
Who are you? Where do you live? Like, what's your deal? Like, how did this come to your ears? And yeah, I mean, you don't even have to like I said, you don't have to give us a list. You don't have to be clever. I just want to know.
Yeah.
I just want to know where you are.
What do you like? What do you hate?
Who's your favorite?
Don't start with that again.
Is it Alonzo?
I want to see
that. Or me?
You're pathetic.
I know it's me. Anyway, I just want to know.
All right.
I want to know who you are.
We'll be back next week with more new reviews, and we are going to do a little separate 15-minute show where we spoil the hell out of both The Invitation and Midnight Special.
More than just spoiling, I have so many things
to talk about them
say
in a way that we can't talk about them without spoiling them. Yeah,
I want to have this conversation about these movies, and I can't do it in good conscience. And
yes, until people had a chance to see them first,
and wreck that the joy, the fun of these very different films.
Yeah,
that I think are both great.
So until next time, thank you for listening.
Goodbye.